This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Book Waves, Art Waves programs on KPFA-FM and Pacifica Syndication. Lance Gardner is the Executive Artistic Director of Marin Theater and has been since October 2023. He is an actor in the Bay Area. For several years, he was a live event producer at KQED. Why executive artistic director and not just artistic director?
Many theaters have a dual executive model of an artistic director and a managing director. Our theater currently has a single executive model. So I am artistic director, but I am also fulfilling the duties of what a managing director would fulfill, which are administrative duties, overseeing everything in the theater.
I interviewed Jason Minidakis several times over the years. How close did Marin Theater come to falling apart completely after Jason left? Was it that serious?
That's a great question. It's always serious when there's a transition. I think a theater is always in danger of losing its way and losing its identity. But Marin Theater was not close to falling apart. The previous generations of boards had set us up well for the future, and we were able to weather the storm of both the pandemic and the artistic executive transition, and we're looking forward to building ourselves back up to the full capacity that the theater was at years ago.
How bad was it though? I mean, I remember there were only like two. I think there were just two plays one year.
Yeah, like many theaters, Marin Theater Company at the time received emergency funding from the government, from individuals. That was sufficient to support the theater in the dark times. You know, there were necessary cutbacks for financial reasons, for capacity reasons. They were moves that were made in order to avoid catastrophe. I wouldn't say that the theater was ever close to disaster. You know, part of what strengthens us as an organization is that we own our building. We own the theater that we produce in. And so anytime that you think about whether or not we're close to any sort of immediate disaster, you have to consider that we have big responsibilities to maintain our building and maintain our place in the community. And we can continue to produce on a slim budget if we have to.
You came over from Aurora. How are they doing? Because I know that they looked like this last season wasn't even going to happen over there.
Yeah, I was the president of the board of directors before taking on this role in Marin. And I can't speak to Aurora's health as an organization now, but I'll say that, you know, similarly to Marin Theater, there were extreme challenges that were brought on by the pandemic. There, of course, were the financial challenges of not being able to produce theater for a live audience. But then there are also the challenges of courting an audience to come back after getting out of the habit of attending to the theater. We're not a culture of theater goers, you know, as a rule. And so when people fall out of that habit, it's doubly hard to bring them back.
Most theater companies seem to have fallen off by as much as 30% season subscribers. I guess that was the case at both Aurora and now Marin.
Yeah, I can't speak to Aurora's numbers. I don't have those in front of me, and I don't feel that it would be appropriate to share information about them. But here at Marin, you know, it's even greater than that. We were looking back to 2019, we were somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,500 or 1,600 subscriptions. We're now at about 600. We've lost more than 50% of our subscribers to many things. You know, there were people who moved out of the area during the pandemic. people who chose not to come back for health reasons after the pandemic. We certainly lost some people to the pandemic itself. And now we have the job of informing those who were subscribers that we're back, that we're better than ever, and that there's something worth coming out for. And also the job of attracting new both subscribers and single ticket buyers to our shows, because even at the prior capacity, the theater was not thriving. It has always been a theater that was sort of teetering on an edge. And I think part of that is to do with the location. The audience here is great in Marin, but I'm not sure that there's a large enough population here in Marin of theater goers to sustain the theater. So we're trying to get the word out that if you live in San Francisco, if you're in the Richmond or the Marina, it's easier and faster most days to get here to Mill Valley than it is to go downtown in San Francisco to see a show. And we have free parking. And even the bridge toll is cheaper than parking is in the city. So we're really trying to court anybody who believes in art that we're a powerhouse and we're ready to welcome you with open arms.
A couple of quick questions then. Why the name change? And of course, the other thing is that the audiences, particularly at Marin, even compared to, say, Berkeley Rep or ACT, were old before the pandemic.
Yeah. Well, old is not bad. Old is just as good as young when it comes to an audience, but diversity in age is necessary for longevity. I'm not concerned at all with the age of our audience. It's really a matter for me of building new audience, whether that's more people of a certain age or younger people, we need to bring them all in.
Why the name change?
Oh, the name change. A few reasons. It was time for a change of some kind. The theater was due for a radical change, a refresh. This is the second time the name has been changed of this theater. This theater started out in 1966 as the Mill Valley Center for the Performing Arts. And at that time, produced plays, but also screened films and hosted musical performances. When the decision was made by the founders to focus on theater alone, it became Marin Theater Company. When I walked through the door, I felt a need to set ourselves apart on the national stage. And there is a very prominent MTC in New York City. And I felt that if we were to continue to produce nationally recognized work, that it was important to have a name that wasn't shared with any other theater in abbreviation. So that was a big driver, but I didn't want to stray too far from where we were. So this was an obvious choice, and it's been well received by the community. You know, I don't begrudge anyone for calling us MTC. It rolls off the tongue pretty nicely, but, you know, I like the new name quite a bit.
Lance Gardner, let's talk a little about you. You've been an actor. I've seen you on stage several times. You've quit the profession multiple times. In, I think it was 2020, one of your times where you decided to give up on being an actor, you made some comments to Lily Janiak of The Chronicle about what it's like to try to make a living being a stage actor. Knowing your complaints about the fact, which are valid, about the fact that you couldn't actually be a full-time actor given what you were receiving, now that you're on the other side, how do you reconcile the fact that you can't afford to pay actors so that they can have a living wage and only be actors, knowing that you quit for that very reason?
Yeah, I think you phrased that in a way that makes the point that we can't afford to do it right now. And I feel a great deal of guilt that we're unable to do that. But we as an organization and many theaters here and elsewhere are financially unable to pay what people deserve to be paid to do the work that they're doing. And I do hope that we can change that at some point, but that requires investment from the community, and understanding in our audience of that problem and a desire to provide gifts, financial gifts of any size that will help to support those things. We're at a point right now where we're building up, and once we're on truly solid footing, that's when we can start to consider how we might be able to do those things. But until we solve our own problems, get our own house in order, we're not able to address those problems. And that's really very disappointing to me. I think the story might have been different if I walked into a theater with deep pockets and an endowment. We could look at things differently, and there are changes that could be made. As it is, this is a lot like running a startup. Although we have the infrastructure, there's a lot that is still being rebuilt from the ground up.
During those interregnums, did you ever consider moving to the dark side, which means going to LA and trying to get a gig on a TV show or something?
I considered it, but I have a family. I have three children, and there was no point in my life where I felt like it would be the right thing to do to move my children to LA or to New York, and I didn't want to leave them for any significant period of time. So that's really been, fatherhood has been a big driver in all of my decisions in my adult life, really.
It's kind of funny, if someone has a heart attack in the audience while you're there, you're an EMT, you could go save them.
That is true. We do have an AED in the theater that I'm more familiar with than anybody else.
How was it working at KQED?
It was great.
You produced the live stuff, right? You produced.
I did. I learned a lot at KQED, and I don't think that I would be as capable as I am now without the things that I learned there. So I learned several things. First, I did an audio journalism program, the Audio Academy at KALW, where I became a journalist. And as someone who has been telling mostly fictional stories on stage for my career, considering how to tell the truth was a very interesting and important step for me. Not that I didn't know how to tell the truth in real life, but telling it in story form was very instructive. So then to take those skills to KQED and apply them to a format that was, that had been relatively unexplored here by these news organizations was really interesting. When I showed up there, it was the beginning of a live events program that we in that department were tasked to build out. And before the pandemic, we were doing live events around San Francisco as our space was being renovated. And people were coming alone after work with their backpacks on for very serious conversations to sit down and engage civically. The pandemic happened. We produced some stuff online, and then our space opened and we went back to the kind of programming that we had been doing before the pandemic, and people weren't showing up. And I think part of that was because appetites had changed. The pandemic shifted something in people's minds. Also, people weren't going to work. They were working from home. So it was going to take a different draw to get them out. And so I was really forced to consider the audience that we had and the audience that we were able to build, and started experimenting with formats and discovered really an audience that I wasn't expecting to find of younger people who wanted to come out for really engaging, active and interactive programs on site.
How do you think that experience comes out now in, say, a 5-play season at Marin? What did you learn about bringing an audience in that kind of is something that maybe other theater companies don't really know.
The first thing I learned, again, going back to the truth, is that the truth is important to me. And so when I approach a season, I feel a drive to include truth-based stage pieces in that season. I think that theater can, in a way, do the work of journalism. I also understand that that event production, theater production, is holistic, that it doesn't begin and end when the lights go out or come on in the theater, that it starts in the parking lot. It starts with the ticket buying journey, right? So paying close attention to how and why people are finding you through marketing is paramount. Presenting yourself well inside and outside of the theater, and then creating supplementary or complementary activities for people that support the work that you're doing on stage can help to connect with those who may not yet be connected with the stage work. So for example, for each play this year, we are also hosting exhibits, fine art exhibits in our lobby that either play on the themes of the play or are complementary to the themes and aesthetics. So we're partnering with some artists and some galleries and perhaps a museum or two to do that. And people who might come for those things alone may discover theater that they wouldn't otherwise have discovered. We're also expanding our pre and post show programming to include more robust conversations around the themes of the plays. So it's those kinds of things that that engage a larger, more diverse audience.
I'm going to ask you about a comment you made in that interview with Lily in 2020. You talked about how degrading it was to be asked to allow non-Black directors to assess the quality of my performance of my Blackness. And it's further degrading to be asked to say the N-word at an audition when I'm the only in the room. Here you are 5 years later. How do you, as an actor and as an artistic director, deal with issues like that, which could also be, say, a gay person being asked to be gay by a straight director in a way that's kind of demeaning too, or a woman being asked to be a certain way by a male director?
I start by listening. I think that's always the key to these kinds of conversations, listening to our artistic community and understanding, trying to understand the nuances of opinions like these. I also understand that individual opinions are going to vary greatly. Something that I feel is degrading to me is not necessarily going to feel degrading to another person. So these are the kinds of things that I consider when I'm planning a season, when I'm choosing directors. And we try to avoid these situations. They're not entirely avoidable, but it was important to me to express my feelings and to start that conversation because I felt like it wasn't being considered. I think that if it had been more carefully considered in the situations that I was talking about, that it would not have been so degrading. People are allowed to make mistakes or to disagree, but in my book, it's pretty damnable if they don't at least consider the request.
We know what's just happened in Washington, and we can expect further horrible things to come out of Washington. The question is, how do you, as a theater director, try to ensure that we are, in a way, resisting and at the same time kind of deal with the present and the future all at once, if that makes any sense?
It does. I think, again, there's nothing more powerful than the truth. And I think that we have a unique opportunity to present people with truthful depictions of humanity and ask them to consider their opinions and their role in being complicit or resisting anything in any society. One of the ways that I like to approach considering the time is through the lens of other countries and other times. So I'm not a highly reactive person as an artist. I think there's a place for that, but I prefer to use analogs or parallels from other times and other places to examine our own time and place. For example, the current play that we're rehearsing, Waste, was written in 1906 in the UK and considers how backdoor politics are done. It considers a woman's right to choose and does all of these things in a way that, although are alien to us in terms of time and place, are very familiar. And even the language, it's more than 100 years old, but it doesn't sound like it is.
One of the things that Jason was doing, he wanted to have all 10 August Wilson plays at Marin. Is that project still ongoing?
It has not been consciously ended. I am looking forward to potential opportunities to produce the unproduced plays in the future, but I don't have any news to share on that.
The first play of the season was Yaga, which I missed because I was in Thailand at the time on vacation. So we're talking about Waste by Harley Granville Barker. There were two versions of it, 1906 and 1927. It sounds like you chose the earlier version and you're actually in it. And it's about a politician who wants to de-establish the Church of England and gets into a bit of a pickle about that. So a couple of questions. How did you find it? What was the decision about which version to use? And how did Cary Perloff come into it as director?
It's all the same answer, and it all comes down to Cary. When I was hired, Cary reached out to me and asked how she could support me as an artistic director and as somebody who she respected and believed in. And I told her that the best way to support me would be if she would be willing to direct a play. I asked her if there were any plays that she was dying to direct, and she presented Waste. And this version is actually a cutting of her doing. So she has based this primarily on the earlier version, using some elements of the later version. I won't call it fully an adaptation because it is almost 100% the words of Harley Granville Barker, but cut by Cary Perloff. I was thrilled when she presented this play. I read it the same day and told her the following day that I wanted to do it. First and foremost, it is a language play. I love the English language at its best, and this is certainly that. So outside of plot and theme, it's a delicious play to speak. And then on top of that, it has this really very human story about complicated people making complicated decisions and considering their own complicity in the outcome of their decisions. It's a play about, you know, free choice and how much control a human has over themselves and over their lives. It's a play about power and politics and what drives a person to make the choices that, in this case, he makes. It's a play about women's reproductive rights and what control there is over a woman's right to choose and what the consequences are for doing so or asking someone.
How does it feel to be back on stage?
It feels great. You mentioned that I quit a number of times, and I stand by that. And I wasn't planning to come back on stage, to be perfectly honest, this year. Cary asked me several times if I would do this, and I said no. And at last, I felt like it would be a real treat to perform this very complex play about a complex man, and an opportunity that I don't think I would have gotten in another situation. And Carrie is a really wonderful director and a joy to work with. And so the rehearsal room is a great place to be.
It's also in the public domain, which kind of helps helps you guys financially, which is very helpful. I noticed on the website that each of the four plays that are remaining have a tiny little blurb about what they are. Is that in order to kind of attract different audiences, you think?
It is. Yeah. Like I said, you know, we lost a lot of subscribers in the last few years. And so we need to make an argument for our own existence. And the best argument is through the plays that we produce. How do people choose what they want to see? Unlike a movie, we don't have trailers that we can play in front of other plays. We have a finite budget for marketing outside of the theater. So giving people an opportunity to get a little taste of what we have to offer is very important. And also buying tendencies have shifted generally in the industry away from subscriptions. While there are still people who appreciate and enjoy and take advantage of subscriptions, there are quite a few single ticket buyers who I suspect are not going to be converted to subscribers anytime soon. And we're not going to deny that that's the case.
That opens February 6th.
Is the date of the first preview. And we open the show on February 11th. That's the official opening, but performances begin on the 6th.
Do you have space in there to extend for a week or two on any of these shows?
With this show, we probably don't. People should get their tickets and get in there, because I don't believe it's possible to extend this one or the next one, the final two. There may be room, but you know, we should be so lucky.
And the next show, Lance Gardner, is Mrs. Krishnan's Party. And that's an interactive play. It's by a group, originally by a group called Indian Inc., which is a theater company. That's in a different theater, or is that in the main theater?
The Boyer is the large theater. This is a show that is actually produced by this company from New Zealand, Indian Inc., and they're currently touring around the United States and will be coming to us. And what we have decided to do, because of the nature of the show and the layout of the show, we will be seating the audience on stage in the round for this. So we'll be building out the stage a little bit to create some extra room. And all of the action and all of the seating will be on stage. The theater seats will be empty and our capacity will be reduced for that show. But I think this is an exciting way to welcome people to the theater in a way that feels new and that creates a real sense of community and togetherness.
It's kind of interactive. Everybody's at this party that's occurring in the back room of a dairy. I guess the actors are from Indian Inc., and it's the same folks that have been in other places. How did that come to you?
A board member recommended it. He had seen that this was being produced around the country last year and found it to be very interesting. So I reached out to the company and got a video of the entire performance. It was just such a joyful, funny, interesting show. Again, from an outside perspective, outside of the United States, that tells a story that is, you know, familiar in its friendship and its joy, but unfamiliar to me in its cultural content and cultural context.
And the third show of this part of the season is It's True, It's True, It's True, which is a courtroom drama using transcripts from a Renaissance trial about an assault toward Artemisia Gentilisi. I interviewed Susan Vreeland, who wrote a novel about it called The Passion of Artemisia some 20 years ago. How did that show come to you?
For this season, I was really looking for things outside of the standard American theater lens. And this I actually saw on video on a British theater streaming channel. and reached out to Breach Theater about the possibility of doing it. This was originally a devised piece. So the original production was very specific to the actors and the company at the time, which for me makes it a very interesting endeavor because they were forced to make a lot of discoveries in the creation of this that don't necessarily translate to the page. And so that gives us the opportunity to similarly make a lot of discoveries on this canvas of a play to create something for ourselves in our own space.
So in that sense, it's not your standard, you have to stick by the words kind of play. You have permission to kind of do a Marin Theater thing with it. Is that what you're talking about?
We certainly will stick by the words. The words are what they are. But in the execution of the play, there's greater leeway for problem solving, greater opportunity for theatricality, I guess I'd call it.
What attracted you to it?
Well, this season, the plays that I have been attracted to, I would say, fall under a feminist umbrella. This was telling a story from hundreds of years ago that has been repeated over and over and over again throughout history. I felt that it was important to include this, again, because it was outside of the scope of our time, but told a timely story. It also attracted me because I love the intersection of fine art and performing arts. This one is going to be performed in the smaller theater, in the Lieberman Studio Theater. This was an opportunity to use a space that we haven't used for this kind of thing in a long time. So everything about it just screamed art. And I think a lot of the time, people in the theater are susceptible to forgetting that we're producing art, works of art. And this is impossible to forget with this play.
Is that theater more like a black box then?
It is.
The final play of the season, which is in June, it's called You Feel Anger, and it's by Mara Nelson Greenberg. This play is more in the traditional find a play that's been performing elsewhere and put it on here. That one was actually at the Vineyard in New York, and it's from the Humana Festival. It's a comedy about a woman who was hired as an empathy coach at a debt collection agency and what happens to her. One thing about it that I found interesting in looking it up was that Ben Brantley in The Times liked the play but didn't like the director, which kind of means that you guys have a shot at putting on a better production.
Well, I didn't see that production, and I'm not sure that I trust any single person's opinion about anything. But I think we always have a shot at putting on a better production, even if it's a great show somewhere else. That's a wonderful thing about live theater, is that we can produce just as good a show or better here in Mill Valley, you know, as they're producing anywhere else in the world. The only thing that Broadway has that we don't is many more millions of dollars. We share actors, we share directors, designers with the biggest, most prestigious theaters. And we're blessed with the opportunity to always have the possibility of succeeding. But yes, again, every play is not a blank canvas, but it is a canvas on which we can paint our own picture. I think that we have a great opportunity, yes, to do something a little bit different from the original productions.
How did you find this play and what drew you to it?
This was, I believe, brought to me by our literary director, Laura Steele. This is one of those that has been floating around in the inboxes and Google Drives of people in the theater for a little while. And it's known to the theatrical community, but hasn't had many opportunities to be produced. And frankly, was one of the buzzier choices in the theater community when it was announced. People are excited to see this produced, excited to give Mara Nelson Greenberg an opportunity to show her work here in the Bay Area. And it's hilarious, hilarious, but also quite impactful. So I'm a sucker for comedy, especially absurd comedy. And this ticks all the boxes of absurd comedy, but it does it with a pretty sharp tongue.
The sense I got is that It starts out very strange and absurdist and then almost goes off the rails in a good way.
It's a very accessible play. It's not so absurd that you that it has no plot or that you won't be able to follow it. But yeah, it sets up a rather absurd scenario, but the absurdity really comes out through the characters. The location, the situations are all familiar. While the male characters are absurd and seem to be almost living in a different world from the female characters through whom the story is told.
How close are you to next season? How many plays will there be?
I hope to have made final decisions on next season sometime in February. I'm hoping that we will be able to produce 5 plays. So this year we are producing 4 plays and we're presenting Indian Ink. This year we also added a short run of a holiday show from Transcendence Theater Company. So that was a total of 6 offerings, but I'm hoping to be able to produce and or present a total of 5. It's really a matter of budget. And if your listeners would like to contribute or be named as a producer on one of these shows, then we can get that much closer to our goal.
With what's happening in Washington, we have not seen censorship yet. But with censorship potentially around the corner, I'm not talking government censorship, I'm talking self-censorship, becomes more important for people to understand that live theater is live theater. Nobody's going to censor a play out of existence. And I think that makes it more important.
Fear is one of the most dangerous human emotions. And it is fear that leads to censorship from governments. And it is fear that leads to self-censorship. There have been plays censored throughout history, and they almost always reemerge. And you find often that those that are censored are some of the better offerings there are out there. So to approach my work without fear, I think, is the most powerful and important approach that I can take.
If everything is streaming, they could cut it off and we won't see it at all. Whereas theater is always live.
It takes a greater level of violence to end a live performance than it does to end a recorded one.
We've been listening to an interview with Lance Gardner, the executive artistic director of Marin Theater, and that's in Mill Valley. The first show coming up now is Waste, which starts February 6th on previews and opens February 11th. And for more information, you can go to marintheater.org. Until next time, I'm Richard Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio Shows on Facebook.